Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and the health and well-being of our communities, of our neighborhoods, of our society, and of the earth itself. Each week on Connect the Dots, I talk with different advocates, activists, authors, scientists, thought leaders, and other experts who illuminate different facets of all the different things that go on in our communities, in our society, and in our world, and how they impact us. For many years, I was a health reporter, and looking at all the good things that we could do for our health and to better our health, eating healthy food, drinking healthy water, and all of those kinds of things. And then about 8 years ago, I turned my attention to the things we do as a society, because all of our personal efforts and all the things that we love and cherish really, you know, won't be going so well unless we also do things as a society that sustain life, that sustain health, and that sustain the planet Earth. And so that's what we talk about every week on the show. This particular week, I am reporting from the Democratic Convention, and our guest on today's show is someone else who's been very involved at both the convention and in the Democratic Party platform. My guest today is David Braun, a co-founder of Americans Against Fracking. We know and love him in New York State from the grassroots embedded community that I've been part of in the achievement of the statewide ban against fracking in New York. And David was a lead organizer and key in attaining this groundbreaking fracking ban that came into being after many years of hard work by him and other leaders, as well as by many, many people in the community who got involved and showed their concern until we finally were able to persuade our governor, Cuomo, to sign a fracking ban in 2014. So we're going to be looking, touching in with David today on the show because he's been part of the Democratic Platform Committee, specifically in terms of its planks and agreements or lack of agreements about in the energy sector and about climate. And so that's what we'll be discussing on today's show. And as we speak, the Democratic Convention is in full swing. So this is the time to really look at what's going on and what lies ahead as this transition and campaign for the next ruling administration of our government is underway. So welcome to Connect the Dots once again, David. So great to have you here again.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me, Allison.
So, so tell us, David, you know, we've heard that the Democratic Party platform is the most progressive platform that we've ever had for the Democratic Party. And you were actually involved and engaged in a member of the platform committee and helped hear the conversations, shape the conversations around what would be on that platform, saw the voting, voted on various planks of the platform. And I know we'll, you know, I think it would be great for people, you know, we hear this phrase, it's the most progressive platform. It's the most progressive platform said by Bernie Sanders. It's been said by many people supporting Hillary Clinton. You know, what is and is not so progressive about the platform this Democratic Party has agreed to and submitted?
Well, there are a number of things that are progressive. You know, they did strengthen or they strengthened some of the language around supporting Social Security. Certainly, that's, you know, very good. We were able to get in some really very powerful language about a World War II style mobilization to bring renewable energy online in response to the climate crisis that we are facing, which was really fantastic and very inspiring moment in the process. The parties had been kind of voting in blocks. And what I mean by the parties is that there were some of the platform committee members were put on the platform by Bernie Sanders. Some were nominated by Hillary Clinton's team. And then Debbie Wasserman Schultz had appointed about 25 of them back in December of last year. So what we saw was a lot of voting in blocks throughout the day. And I'll go into some of that in a little bit. But let me kind of stay with the positive for right now. There were a couple of very inspiring moments when people didn't vote in blocks. And we presented this World War II-style mobilization, and I think really spoke to the hearts of the members of this committee, members of the Democratic Platform Committee. And, you know, we even actually heard from one of the members of the Platform Committee who is actually a consultant for the gas industry, for the fracking industry, that they were planning on voting against our amendment, against this World War II-style mobilization. And we made such a compelling case and had so much momentum behind us by the time the vote came. They just didn't feel that they could oppose it. And so they kind of stepped out of the way and allowed there not to be a block vote on that. And I think we had, you know, an overwhelming majority, but out of something like 180 platform committee members, we had something like seven people that voted against it. So it was really just extraordinary. One of a few times that happened throughout the day, that was, you know, very exciting and you know, very, very wonderful. The other time that happened throughout the day was when we were talking about declassifying marijuana as a Schedule I drug. And the platform committee members from the Hillary Party and the Wasserman Schultz nominations, they went rogue, and it was quite a thing to see. Literally, the vote was happening, and as we were voting, we voted with these clickers, these handheld clickers, and you can see actually on the giant screens how people were voting. They were all being recorded, and you could see how many yeses there were and how many noes there were, and it was neck and neck. It was, you know, 76 to 75 and then 77 to 76, and it was really just quite a kind of nail biter. And meanwhile, Hillary's people are running around saying, she doesn't believe in this. She doesn't. And they're waving their hands, saying that, you know, the senator didn't believe in declassifying medical marijuana, declassifying marijuana. But here her platform committee members were saying that they, you know, they were disagreeing and openly. So that was a couple of very inspiring moments that happened throughout the day. And then there were some moments that were less inspiring. One of those moments came, I guess, you know, before, in fairness to the Clinton team, they felt that they had moved a lot on something like Social Security. And there was some language coming into the Orlando meetings on July 9th and 10th that was supportive of Social Security and said, you know, ideally they want to strengthen Social Security. So that's, you know, that's great and fantastic. And they felt that this was a kind of a bold thing to say, because for the past decade or so, the Republicans have all wanted to kind of dismantle it, Social Security. We've actually seen Barack Obama at one point, I think, talked about potentially weakening it. So this was, they felt, moving in the right direction for Social Security. But sadly, one of the platform committee members had proposed an amendment that simply tied Social Security to an inflation adjustment, so that as inflation went up, people's Social Security would do the same. As the cost of food goes up, people get those more, you know, the pennies or dollars or whatever it takes so that they can continue to eat. And we had testifying, you know, social workers who work with many people who are on Social Security, who were testifying about, you know, some of their clients. Some of their clients take one meal and extend it throughout the day. Other clients were eating cat food because they couldn't afford real food. And you just, these stories were, and they're heart-wrenching stories. And then when it came to a vote, the vote happened in a block. And so all of the Sanders platform committee members voted for the inflation adjustment, and all of the Wasserman, Schultz, and Clinton members voted against it. And it was heartbreaking because to me, you know, growing up a lifelong Democrat who might have strayed into the Green Party along the way, but, you know, growing up a lifelong Democrat and having Democratic values, to me, this was something that was very straight down the ticket, Democratic principle. We look out for old folks. We look out for those less fortunate. Social Security is like one of the bedrock tenets of our social structure, looking after those who need it, who have paid into this system in their life's work. It's just asinine that we would not just vote to give them that cost of living raise, if you will, when it comes to, you know, making the somebody on a fixed income be able to do things like eat. And so it was so disheartening to see the Clinton Dems on this committee vote against it. And I just thought, what's happened to this party? What's happened to these people? And why on earth isn't Hillary Clinton supporting the most simple thing, gesture that could be done? You know, and again, something that is just a standard, straight down the ticket, Democratic policy position. So that was really eye-opening. And that happened fairly early on in the proceedings. Mm-hmm. And it really
clued me in to what we were dealing with.
Yeah,
because, you know, one of the things that I hear out and about in the dialogue among people is, you know, the eagerness or the promise, you know, that we can push Clinton. Obviously, you know, if elected, we can push her. If she's more centrist or more outright Republican, as some might believe, than we would like, you know, that's okay because she's listening and we can push her. Whereas Donald Trump is a law unto himself, and, you know, Lord knows what he'll do. He'll, you know, he might do anything, and he's not, you know, if it doesn't fit his peculiar philosophy or his egotistical need at the moment, you know, he won't be very pushable. And I think that latter point is probably quite legitimate. But the sense that we can push or influence Clinton, you know, on two scores, that's not what your experience on the platform committee is really revealing. On the one hand, how do we push when somebody sort of sews up all the votes in advance and it tells people how they will be voting? That doesn't seem flexible. It doesn't seem all that democratic. I mean, it may be practical in terms of attaining power and making sure you hold it in a certain way. But then, you know, how do you have a consensus process of then determining, you know, what it is that the people want? So that block voting in and of itself is a problem. And then, you know, the fact that they have higher numbers and the deck is kind of stacked, you know, where is the willingness or interest in hearing or arriving at a consensus present in the process? And how influenceable is it if, the top individual has the say and, you know, the other members, the delegates, the legislators, you know, whatever, I mean, here we're talking about delegates, we could be talking about legislators in future. You know, if it isn't sort of a group consensual process, then what is it?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, I'm going to have to, you know, I think push back a little bit on, I think you mentioned that this is a way to you know, build power, you know, this kind of the block voting that she was doing. And I think quite the opposite. If I had seen them being more willing to bend on certain things that weren't so, you know, when we came to issues of pushing on like corporate power, for instance, TPP being one of them, Ben Jealous introduced an amendment, and the amendment was being tacked on, and it was like four words, I think it was. So there was a whole long amendment that talked about trade policies that had been added. And it talked about how, you know, Democrats don't like trade policies that are unfair to American workers and to the, I think it mentioned the environment. Then it kind of went on. And then I think it said, and some of these trade policies include TPP along with some others, right? So it was this very roundabout language that never came out and said, and that's why we oppose the TPP. And so Ben Jealous basically, and for those that don't know, Ben Jealous is the former head of the NAACP, and is a, you know, his family is a historical, you know, civil rights family, and he's just an inspiring guy, you know, like just one of those folks that you meet him and you, you know, it's, I, for, you know, I feel silly saying this, but you feel like you're in the presence of someone great, you know, when you're with him, he just, you know, speaking about very, very important things. And so he calls their bluff and he introduces this bill, and his bill says, and that's why we don't support, Democrats don't support the TPP. That was the language he wanted added to the platform. And again, what happened? Voted in blocks. And so here are, you know, and this is indicative of the whole Clinton campaign and who she is as a leader, because you hear a lot of lip speak, you know, there she is on the campaign trail after Bernie says, you know, he's against TPP. You know, Hillary starts adopting some of Bernie's positions. Well, I'm against the TPP, which was like, okay, well, that's news to us. But then she says months ago that she's against the TPP. But meanwhile, all of her surrogates vote in a block against language that simply says, we oppose the TPP. And why is that? Why didn't they just vote that language that they say is what they stand for? And, you know, there's the, you know, the personification of who she is and who her followers are. It was overheard by one of my colleagues, and of course some could say this is hearsay, but a friend of mine who is on the platform committee literally heard one of her people say, I just voted against my conscience. I think I'm going to be sick. And and we saw that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know some of those people that are, you know, Hillary Clinton platform committee members, and they're decent, kind, loving people. And I think when you appeal to their better natures, you see that, and they're willing to really vote their conscience. But for the most part, because the proceedings were somewhat sterile, and because the, you know, maybe some of the speakers maybe weren't compelling enough. There was a lot of, I mean, mistakes on the Bernie Sanders side is there was a lot of speakers that got up and lectured some of the Hillary Clinton supporters on why they were so right and why the Clinton supporters were so wrong. Well, guess what? You're not going to win bees without honey, you know, and unsurprising, like every time, one of these people, of course, they were making great points, intelligent points, articulate points. Definitely, they were very right in what they're saying. But you know what? Sometimes you can be right or you can win, you know, and it's really a choice between the two. And some of the Sanders platform committee members were more enamored with being right than they were with actually trying to convince some of the Clinton folks to come their direction. And I think overall, that's one of our main problems, is that we have to win hearts and minds. We have to win people from taking corporate money. We have, you know, I mean, of course, some people you just have to boldly oppose. But I think this kind of creating an adversarial environment just causes people to dig in. And that was, you know, incredibly unfortunate when I would see that happen. But still, nonetheless, that doesn't excuse the inconsistency between what people said and people did. And I also, you know, I want to mention this. So the fracking amendment, if I may talk about that was something
you were trying to get a fracking ban into the platform. That was the original goal, to ban fracking in the Democratic Party platform.
Right. I mean, everyone called it a fracking ban, but it was really a moratorium. It was just a kind of a halt, and it didn't really have an end time, but presumably it was until it's proven safe, which of course will be never with the chronic well casing failures and the pathways, other pathways of contamination, and the sheer amounts of chemicals that they're using in fracking, and the high pressure that they're shoving all these chemicals into the ground. I mean, it's just an untenable practice, no matter how you slice it. But we were calling for basically what we called a ban, but it was actually technically a moratorium. And Josh Fox presented the amendment and presented it. And then Trevor Hauser, who was a consultant for the energy industry, and Steve Horn from DSmog Blog recently wrote a really great piece for DSmog Blog that really exposes the connections between Trevor Hauser and the oil and gas industry. He's a partner in the Rhodium Group, and he basically called for the closing of the Halliburton loophole, which you would think would be a good thing, except when you have a Republican-controlled House and Senate. There's just no way that the Halliburton loophole would also be closed or would be closed.
David, let's just define what the Halliburton loophole is for any listeners that may be unfamiliar with it. This was a provision put into the 2005 energy bill, which was signed by former President George Bush. And the energy bill was largely designed by Vice President Richard Cheney. And he, as a former president of the company Halliburton, which builds the concrete casings and pipelines and, you know, other things that are part of the fracking physical process, is a big friend to the gas and oil industry. And in that the 2005 Energy Act, he put in all kinds of provisions that really bypassed normal environmental disclosure and regulations that would normally be in place in terms of, you know, the things that were crafted by Congress and voted in, like the Clean Energy, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, you know, all different kinds of things like that that are designed to protect our environment and our health. And this, basically, for this one industry, the Halliburton loophole, you know, allows them to bypass these safety measures that are there on our behalf.
Right. Yeah.
And so what you're saying is that it's a nice idea to propose doing it, but that they wouldn't be able to get it through Congress in any case. So it's it sounds good, but it's, you know, it may not happen.
Realistically, what's interesting about this is that Hauser is a consultant for the Rhodium Group, but we do know that the Rhodium Group receives funding from ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, Statoil, and others. So It's interesting that someone who is a consultant for the energy industry, for the fossil fuel industry, would try to close the Halliburton loophole, which those companies, I think, enjoy a great amount of freedom as a result of not having to be regulated by these laws that would probably effectively shut down fracking entirely. These laws were, I think it's worth mentioning, were hard won. Environmentalists worked hard for years and years and years to win these really key environmental safeguards, specifically from industries, this industry. I mean, fracking was pretty much the reason why those were passed. And so to exempt this industry from these important safeguards is, would be like knowing that safety belts or seat belts in cars save lives, but allowing Chevrolet not to put them into their cars. It's just absolutely ludicrous. Anyway, so the other thing that was in Hauser's provision was there was a big Trojan horse in there, and it was that they called, they wanted to replace leaky pipelines in order to do two things. One was to protect the climate from climate change because of leaky methane, and the other was to create high-paying jobs. And those are, big time buzzwords. One is kind of a giveaway to the unions that are in the room. And the other one is a very subtle ploy to make fracking a safe and clean energy, which is impossible. Pathways of contamination open up, and those pathways of contamination not only include, all of these chemicals and volatile organic compounds and other naturally occurring, toxic components, but it also includes methane. And we know this. We know, there was a field in Utah where they did a fracking field, where they did a flyover, and they know that their test that they did in this field was very accurate, because the previous day there had been high winds that had, blown away all of whatever residual methane there was. And so when they did this flyover test to test the methane, they found that about 17% of the methane that is being extracted in this field was being released into the atmosphere. And of course, methane is 86 times more greenhouse gas trapping qualities than carbon dioxide in a 20-year period. So you don't need a whole heck of a lot to leak out to have this really intense greenhouse gas and climate change effect. And there's a lot of gas leaking. And so we have this provision Hauser,
I just want to interject, because it seems like, this is an argument, the idea that fracking, pipelines, and all this could, through some, change in technology or, patching some holes and gaps or something like that, could be rendered safe, is an old, argument. I feel like the clock has just been turned back 8 years. We're in the time before the studies that showed all this leakage and all this damage have been done. We're in a time when the companies suddenly 8 years ago that, now we're the 8 years ago, the companies were saying fracking is safe. And all of the media parroted fracking is safe. And then, that's before the studies were done. That was before it showed an increasing effect, direct impact on climate change, because they hadn't been measuring the methane leaks even originally. Then they measured them and they found they were having a much more profound effect. 8 years ago, the Environmental Defense Fund was saying, we're working with industry to make fracking safe. We'll we'll fix this problem, and then it's going to be a clean energy form and all of this. And, of course, 8 years later, they've never been able to do it. So this almost sounds like, you know, we suddenly have amnesia.
Well, in fact, there is that recent story that just came out about the device that was being used to test for methane leakage was completely underestimating all of the measurements, which Bob Howarth from Cornell University has been saying all along, and the industry has been blowing him out of the water. But he was right, and in fact, he was right times 10. So, I mean, it's egregious. And this is what was so disheartening to me, because I do want to believe that people are inherently good. But I watched as Trevor Hauser and the picks by Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So there was two other players that were basically whipping votes to make this happen. One of those was Carol Browner, who is the chairwoman for the board of directors for the League of Conservation Voters, which is purportedly an environmental, she used to be at the EPA, but now she's chairwoman of the League of Conservation Voters, which is, you know, supposed to get elected leaders into office who are going to look after the environment, right? So that's a total joke. And the other one was Wendy Sherman, who also is very, very close to the Clinton campaign, and both of them work for the Albright Stonebridge Group. The Albright Stonebridge Group is founded and run by the U.S. Secretary of State under President Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright. She has a private equity capital investment wing named Albright Capital Management. That wing owns a 10% stake in a fracking company formerly known as Frack Rock International. So they have financial ties to the fracking industry, which is poisoning people all across the country, which has never been proven safe. And they are whipping votes by the majority of the platform committee members so that Democrats continue to support this inherently toxic practice that is poisoning good Americans all across the country. And of course, Obama forced the shutdown of three studies by the EPA whose preliminary results showed that fracking was the likely cause of their water contamination. And these are people whose hair are falling out. These are people that were suffering serious health impacts. Those studies are shut down. And here we are entering into the next phase, right? Clinton has just been nominated by the Democratic Party. And here we go into the next phase of the expansion of fracking. And it's a total catastrophe about to continue on the American people. And people are sleeping through it. And it is a travesty that we are doing this to innocent Americans. It's unconscionable that these people, Carol Browner has completely abdicated her duty as a guardian and a steward of the environment. She should step down along with all of the other members at the League of Conservation Voters, at the NRDC, at EDF, at Sierra Club, that continue to support natural gas as a bridge fuel. It is not a bridge fuel. It is a bridge to nowhere. The climate crisis, forget for a moment poisoning Americans. Forget for a moment people drinking water for years and getting cancers and having, their infections break through their skins and return visits to the hospital with no idea of what's going on. Forget for a moment any of that. And let's just focus on the climate angle. Hillary Clinton says that she acknowledges that climate change has dire consequences. Meanwhile, all of her and all of her surrogates are making money off the end of the world. It is no secret that Hillary Clinton exported fracking around the world. It's no secret. It's been widely discussed. She brought it into, tried to get it into countries all around the world, and now she wants to continue that. Meanwhile, she goes to New York while she's campaigning, where a ban on fracking has been enacted. And, you know, God bless Andrew Cuomo for doing that and his health department for studying the issue and saying, whoa, this is toxic. I mean, the commissioner of the Department of Public Health basically said he wouldn't let his kid live next to a fracking rig. So kudos to Governor Andrew Cuomo for having the sense to not poison the people of his state. But shame on Hillary Clinton for trying to doublespeak and say, oh, I would support a fracking ban if that's what people in the community wanted. Well, guess what? She fought those same fracking bans in other countries. And in places like Mexico, where in the New Deal, they had taken the oil industry and made it private, Hillary Clinton, where they had taken the oil industry and made a private industry a public industry, so that it was the oil industry in Mexico became a publicly owned entity. She helped privatize it, and then people from that worked with her went on to then financially benefit from those arrangements. So
unbelievable.
Clinton.
I just want to ask a question here, which is, you know, you mentioned Trevor, what is his last name again?
Trevor Hauser. Yes.
So what is his role in all of this? Because what you're saying is there are two parties who are whipping the delegates, who are voting on the platform, who are resisting a vote on fracking and are resisting a definitive vote on the TVP. And so the parties who are actually, you know, telling the delegates how to, the Clinton and Wasserman nominated delegates how to vote, and they themselves have a financial interest. You're saying that Hillary Clinton has long time financial ties to individuals and companies that that benefit from these kinds of policy decisions, and then you're saying that Trevor Hauser also has industry ties, and this was detailed in Steve Horn's article. And what is I guess the question is, what is Trevor Hauser's role? He was listed as being Clinton's energy advisor. What is the, or is this all leading to an energy program under a Clinton administration that's going to, under the false flag of clean energy, going to be reintroducing and expanding fracking and pipelines?
Well, and that's exactly it. Like, Trevor Hauser is clearly gunning to be probably the energy secretary. And under the energy secretary, even though Josh Fox, you know, a good friend of mine, fought boldly to get language in the platform that says we incentivize renewable energy above natural gas power plants, guess what? A guy like Trevor Hauser is going to just ignore that. He's going to say, well, yeah, sure, we're incentivizing it, and we're putting in some wind turbines here and some, but, you know, we've got all this gas, and it just makes sense for us to, you know, we've got it here. It's a resource. It's ours. Let's just put it to good use. But guess what? You put in a pipeline, that's an investment. And people want return on their investments. And it goes, you know, it goes much deeper, sadly, is that I'm not going to go into because it implicates other environmental organizations that we have, many of us have respect for. But, you know, when somebody spends, you know, $1.5 billion on a natural gas power plant, that's not a 10-year investment. That's an at least a 50 to a 75 and possibly even a 100-year investment. So we are like literally tipping on the edge of the end of the world here by saying, hey, we need to take immediate action now. And meanwhile, we're investing in fracking infrastructure that the investors will want to continue to use for the next 100 years. And Trevor Hauser is the guy that is architecting this to all happen, which is, you know, just wholly irresponsible and just so disheartening. So
that is terrible.
I have an upcoming show, David.
I have an upcoming show with people who are developing clean energy in New York State. And the thing that's very clear is that takes investment too. So you pay lip service to clean energy, to renewable energy. We're going to solve the problem. You pay lip service to climate change, but actually, you know, there's a choice. You know, it's not like you can't have, you know, this whole thing of a little of everything, but really we're going to put our money, you know, and all the, these, you know, in billions of dollars in of investment in these toxic forms of energy while paying some lip service over here. We're going to give lip service to the climate, but we're really doing these things that are going to accelerate climate change. I mean, and, you know, people who are not well versed in these issues, which are many, many, many people, you know, that have not lived in these regions or, not, you know, not been directly impacted, they hear someone stand up, give a speech, mention climate change. They hear someone else give a speech, and he's a denier. But this is a different form, a much more sophisticated form. It's not as totalitarian a form as in, you know, forget it, I don't believe in it. But it's a sophisticated and equally sinister form of climate denial.
Well, I'd say it's even more sinister because it gives the illusion that something is being done and the problem is being addressed. But meanwhile, under the table, a lot of hanky-panky and funny business is going on. And here's, and there's a lot of evidence that actually bears all of this out. And so one of the things that Hauser did when he was talking about how great it is that we're going to replace these leaky pipelines and clearly demonstrating his interest to continue and actually increase fracking, he said this. He said, when we had air pollution from steel production in Pittsburgh, our response was not to let's ban steel production. He said what we did instead is we effectively reduced the pollution from steel production, and we can do the same thing here. We have the ability, and here is this narrative that the Clinton Dems are putting forward. We have the ability to do the same thing here. At least we should try first. We should try before throwing some millions of union households under the bus. Now, I'll tell you, there is not one union worker on any of those fracking rigs. And often the pipeline workers are not union workers either. They're working 12-hour shifts, sometimes 24-hour shifts, on the 24 hours off. I mean, he's totally disingenuous. So that clearly shows, it demonstrates what his intention is. The other thing that he did is throughout the platform committee, I twice tried to go up to make friendly amendments to amendments that were being proposed. And so what I would do is I would approach the mic, and the phrase, that amendment would say clean, it would have some reference to moving towards clean energy. And I would go up to the mic and say to, I'd like to put in just a friendly amendment that we say clean renewable energy, simply adding one word renewable in the heart of it. And the author, at one point, the author said to me, oh yeah, I think that that's fine. Hold on, let me just go check. The author walked over, talked to Hauser, and Hauser said, no, that's not acceptable. So apparently Hauser spoke for all of the amendments that were being put forward around energy by the Clinton campaign. And also what that is that's indicative that he doesn't want it to say renewable because he has every intention of fracking the heck out of the United States. And it's disgusting. I mean, he wants to keep trying, but you can keep trying, but people are going to keep getting poisoned. And that's what's like really sick and diabolical about this, is that in real life, people's lives are being ruined by fracking, while a guy like Hauser and Hillary Clinton are making tons of money. And most noteworthy here is that they just built a second Panama Canal. Now, why is this? Well, LNG tankers, because they're humongous, can't fit.
That's liquefied natural gas. Mm-hmm.
Liquefied, yes, liquefied natural gas. So what do? To ship natural gas to foreign markets, you have to cool the natural gas down to something like negative 250 some odd degrees Fahrenheit, and then it turns into a liquefied natural gas at that low temperature. So they put it on these giant tankers that, you know, you see they're rather kind of bulbous and they're gargantuan. And so these tankers will likely be filled somewhere on the East Coast. There are numerous, or something like 20 different applications for permits to create LNG facilities that these pipelines will be connecting to. Now, of course, all these pipelines are using eminent domain. Now, you can only use eminent domain when it's in the interest of national interest. So they're calling these facilities, when they apply for them, import-export facilities, because they're not clearly saying we're exporting this gas, because they're taking people's land and, you know, running roughshod through, you know, pristine, you know, lakes and, you know, rivers and farmland. And, you know, they cut down in one section in Pennsylvania, they cut down this this grove of trees that was maple producing. It was a maple syrup farm for this family. They just hacked them all down, ruining these people's livelihoods so they can export this gas that is causing climate change and will continue to around the globe and continue to make money. And that's the ultimate goal for these people, is while they're doing this oil and gas, while they're turning into good Americans into lab rats in a fracking experiment, they're going to be making tons of money exporting this gas around the world, because Japan and other countries in the East have a huge thirst for natural gas. And they're convinced that they can make this climate friendly and climate safe, when the scientists tell us just the opposite. And when the scientists on fracking, like Tony and Grafia, tell us, like with the chronic well casings, you can't make this safe. The industry has yet to do this safely. And why on earth are they making Americans lab rats in their fracking experiment? Now, the worst thing about all of this is that they got good people to go along and vote in blocks with them. And so I actually ran into a legislator from the great state of New York who used to stand with us in New York City and other places around the state and call for a moratorium on fracking. The same exact language that was in Josh Fox's amendment. And I said to him, when I ran into him, he was a Clinton platform committee member, and I probably shouldn't mention his name, just out of respect for him standing with us initially back in New York. But I walked up to him and I said, hey, it's great to see you. Long time no see. Oh, hi, David. How are you? You know, exchange some pleasantries. And I said, listen, are you going to vote for Josh's fracking ban? Are you going to vote for it? And he said, well, we'll have to see. And I said, well, what do you have to see about? I said, it's the same language that we always used to stand next to one another and say at press conferences. It's the same language what we fought for in New York and won. Why on earth wouldn't you vote the same way that you've advocated for almost the past decade? What would change your vote? And he just kept dancing and said, well, we'll just have to see, David. I don't know. We'll just have to see. Now, It's disgusting to me that people who are our allies are now in. And here's what I was told, and I don't know if this is true. I can't confirm it I can't one way or another. But I was told that basically the Hillary Clinton platform committee members, if they don't vote in the block that they in the ways that they're told to vote, that they'll be replaced by alternates. And it's just that simple. And so it's disgusting to see good people that you've worked with for years and who you really believe in as individuals, and who know better, who clearly know better, just denying to themselves what it is that they're voting for, denying to themselves the stories about Trevor Hauser being an agent for the poisonous, toxic fracking industry, denying that Carol Browner and Wendy Sherman are agents for a fracking company that are financially benefiting from these arrangements, denying climate science, denying that they're poisoning good Americans. And, you know, of course, history is going to bear all of this out. And there's, once you act in these ways, you will be remembered as such. And I am confident that we are going to win. And I think that, you know, Bernie Sanders has, you know, people think, well, goodness, we, you know, Hillary Clinton just got the nomination. People are crying, oh, life is over. But I say, no, we just got a taste of the genie is out of the bottle. Integrity politics are here to stay. We always thought we had to vote for the lesser of two evils. But this year, we got a taste of integrity. We got a taste of somebody standing for the we. We got a taste of justice, environmental justice, economic justice, you know, justice for our communities, racial justice. We got a taste of something that we haven't tasted in years. And we're not going to lose. We're not turning back. We might be stuck with Hillary Clinton for right now, but we're going to keep pushing her, and we are not going away without a fight. And next time, we're going to primary her. Like, this is not going away easily. This movement has been born. We have been awakened. We've come alive. And now that people know what it is they can have, it's like when you're in a relationship with a real creep and you realize, wow, I deserve better. And then you get into that better relationship. And you're like, wow, I can actually be happy in a relationship. What was I doing with that creep before that was like, you know, doing terrible things behind my back? I can build a loving, trusting relationship with somebody. And you know what? That's what I deserve. And that's what America's waking up to. And we're not going back after this. We're not going. Trevor Hausers of the world, their days are numbered. This is the last gasp of a dying industry. We got their number. Thanks to great reporting by you, Allison, and people like Steve Horn and the other good members of the press out there. We're getting great information to uncover these stories of conflicts of interest. And we are going to start basing policy on what's right, what's correct, and what is in the interest of public health rather than what's in the interest at the bottom line of toxic industry.
We really need to think about that and really believe that. And it's also one of the reasons why, even if we kind of in this election cycle, my feeling is if we have to behead the monster, and that's the first step, it is only the first step. And that doesn't mean that the choice that's been given us that we're kind of going with for now really should be imposing in this kind of authoritarian manner and actually, you know, controlling the better instincts of good people. Like, for example, the legislator that you encountered, I think that's happening in many different places where people of goodwill are being recruited. And so that's why you do what you have to do to behead the monster, but you don't lose your integrity, you don't lose your discrimination, and you don't throw out the key issues that we've had gains on and that we need to continue having gains on to have viable life here on Earth and to have a democracy. And so, you know, you have to hold two thoughts and not become slavishly devoted just because this is the option right now, but really maintain critical thinking. Don't just, you know, blank out on the issues. And, you know, thank you so much, David, for your continuing and incredible work in bringing to light what's going on with this industry and now what's being planned for us with this knowledge, with this information. We can't just afford to sleepwalk forward and say, well, I solved the problem, I just beheaded the monster. This is a many-headed monster, and it's our inaction and this background of tremendous corporate greed and takeover that is disenfranchising regular people and growing these monsters. And so it's really all hands on deck, not just to behead this one head of the monster, but to look at all of the different things that we need to take care of. And we're actually coming into the end time of our show, and I just, you know, I'm so grateful for both your work on the platform committee, the incredible inspiration of, and let's close, you know, with the thought of the inspiration that, you know, climate is like the World War III of our time. And so we really have to mobilize to protect it. We can't trust a few talking points will be sufficient. We have to stay informed. We have to stay engaged. And, you know, it's really leaders in this, like you, and others in the movement, you know, that really inspire and master, you know, what's going on here, you know, a level of complexity that you know, it's really our duty to follow and join together and act on. So, you know, thank you so much for being with me today on Connect the Dots, David. Yeah.
My pleasure. My pleasure. It's really just about engagement, and people can just engage in this in any way they can, whether it's, you know, going as far as, you know, putting your body on the line and getting arrested at Lake Seneca against some of the fossil fuel, anti-fossil fuel work that they're doing about the gas storage facility. Or maybe it's just writing a letter or making a phone call or signing petitions or creating your own petition. But just get involved. Do something. Whatever your skill level is, people bring different skills to the table. But just doing something and being a part of this incredible movement. And in the end, when we win, you know, when we win, people will feel proud that they were a part of this profound movement for change that's completely changed the course of history and charted a sustainable course where the future generations are able to live and enjoy and breathe clean air, drink clean water, and enjoy all of the life's beauties that we've had the good fortune of enjoying as well. And that's what it's really about, is action for those future generations that are just reflections of ourselves waiting to be born.
Thank you. What a beautiful note to end on. Thank you, David Braun, co-founder of Americans Against Fracking, for this beautiful work you're doing. And thank you, listeners, for spending time with us again this week on Connect the Dots. We'll be back again a week from Wednesday, 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Be well. Yeah.